This ad-free podcast is part of your Slate Plus membership.
Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. April 18th, 2024, the Could You Be a Trump Juror edition. I am David Plotz of CityCast in Washington, D.C. The crows have not yet become my friends. I'm still working on it. It's not going great. Just want to be straight up with that. I'm trying to befriend the crows. They have so far spurned me. Never spurned. No one would ever spurn her from the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School in New Haven, Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hey, David. Hey, John.
Also, he would never be spurned. CBS Primetime's John Dickerson from New York. Hello, John.
Hello, David. Hi, Emily. I feel like I spurned Emily just there without, because I didn't respond to her immediately. I will let you do the introduction, and I'm not fully comfortable with that.
This week on the Gabfest, Trump's first criminal trial, the one for interfering in the 2016 election, gets underway in New York City with jury selection. Then the Supreme Court seems very skeptical, or pretty skeptical, of an obstruction charged filed against 350 January 6th protesters, as well as against Trump involving his 2020 election interference. And then what does Gavin Newsom want? We will talk to The Atlantic's Mark Leibovich about his profile of the pugnacious California governor. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. Jury selection underway in the New York State prosecution of Donald Trump for his interference in the 2016 election. This is the so-called hush money, but maybe misnamed, mislabeled trial, hush money trial. Trump is accused of having his fixer, Michael Cohen, pay more than $200,000 to silence Stormy Daniels about an affair she alleges she and Trump had, and creating fake business records to cover up that payment and thus illegally interfering with the conduct of the 2016 election. This will almost certainly be the only one of the four criminal cases against Trump to go to trial before the election. And thus, it is enormously important to the country, to the campaign, to how the nation is governed for the next 5 years and in perpetuity. Seven jurors were selected on Tuesday. Wednesday was an off day. But that's seven. That's a pretty rapid clip. And Judge Merchan seems to think the trial could start as soon as Monday. So, Emily, what has interested you most of all about these initial phases as the trial sort of gears up, as the engine is turned on and the parking brake is taken off?
Well, we'll see. I mean, we're going to find out. But so far, the skirmishing to prevent this trial from happening, to say that the charges should be dismissed, that the government doesn't have a valid way of taking the misdemeanor charges and converting them into a felony, they have all failed. And in watching those motions go back and forth and looking at the rulings, it looks to me like this case is stronger than I thought initially. And I think part of that, the reason for that is that Alvin Bragg initially didn't really say what the other criminal charges were that made this into a felony. He kind of said other stuff, election law. And now we know that there is a state as well as a federal charge here. And this whole thing that seemed kind of like very novel and weird and precarious looks a little more normal. I'm also being influenced by an interview I listened to with Rebecca Royfe, an NYU law professor who used to be a prosecutor, on the Politics podcast. It's called Politics with an X. And so that's in my head here too. But I think it's true that like the case looks legally more secure. And then it's a tough one for Donald Trump because the proof questions are not that hard. Like the falsified business records, I think, are going to probably look like they were falsified. And then we're going to have a lot of, you know, is Michael Cohen a good witness or not? Do people believe him? I was very skeptical of this case. So I'm not sure I think it's a great idea and is going to work, but it is going to proceed, you know, step by step the way legal cases do. And so far it looks okay.
John, one of the things that's happened, and I think this is really happening on the left, is this attempt to shift the terms of this case from, oh, it's hush money, he's just paying to cover up an affair. That's all that's happening. And the problem with that is who among us wouldn't, found to do something embarrassing, might try to cover it up. Like Donald Trump would not be alone in trying to do that. To change the grounds of the case to he is interfering with the election, as we know he did in the 2020 election. He is trying to change the rules of how you are allowed to comport yourself, using money, fake documents, intimidation, falsified records to trick and deceive voters and thus alter the election. And that seems to be a much stronger ground to be on if you are a prosecutor.
Well, it depends if you're a prosecutor or you're a political pundit, because the case you just made, I mean, the prosecutor's case is, it's not a hush. Well, it is and it isn't a hush money trial. I mean, in the sense that it's a falsifying of business records trial, it's not about the hush money. He's not being charged for having the affair or trying to cover it up. But because of that elevation Emily talked about, which is taking misdemeanors and making them a felony because this was in the service of hiding something in a campaign which runs afoul of federal campaign finance laws, in that sense, it does go back to being about hush money, because the thing he's trying to hush up is for the purposes of helping him in the campaign in 2016. So that's the way in which, because I was trying to actually do a segment about, you know, don't dare call it a hush money trial, because I think it's misleading. It makes people think that this is just about sex and trying to cover it up, which, as you said, David, is not, you know, who among us wouldn't. It reminds me a tiny bit of the Clinton situation with Monica Lewinsky. In other words, it wasn't that he had the affair with her, it's that he lied about having the affair and that's what they were going after him for. But in this case, because of the campaign finance piece, there is a way in which this is a hush money case, because the thing he was trying to hush up was for the purposes of saving his bacon in the campaign. But I think in the legal sense, what interested me about what happened this week was the allowing, as I understand it, of other evidence of this catch and kill scheme, which both helps and hurts, it feels like to me. So the other evidence was with another woman who alleges a long-time affair, 10-month affair with Trump, Karen McDougal, who Trump is on tape recorded talking to Michael Cohen, which helps the prosecution's case, because Cohen is a dodgy witness, but there are actual tape recordings of Trump discussing the details of how to pay off and create the fake company to pay off McDougal through this scheme where McDougal sells her story to the National Enquirer. They take it and then never run it. That's a part of the pattern in practice and the scheme that the prosecutors are alleging, which is the pattern of behavior that then the falsification falls neatly into. In that sense, the broader behavior, whether it's for the campaign or a part of his just regular practice of catching and killing these kinds of stories, does make it a stronger legal case, because why would you falsify the records? Well, because you had this system set up where falsification was a part of that system.
I don't know if this is true for you guys, but by far the most interesting aspect of this to me so far has been the jury selection. You have all these Manhattanites in the jury pool who've been disqualified. About half of the initial pool said they could not be fair. Of those remaining, a lot have been bounced because of social media posts or because when they were sort of interrogated on their level of fairness, they cast doubt on their own ability to be fair. John, you're technically, I mean, you're theoretically in the pool for this. You live in Manhattan. What do you make so far of whether this pool appears to be, a fair pool, a pool that is likely to offer a reasonable chance for Trump to get a fair trial, filled with people who might jury nullify the case because they'll just be like, I'm such a Trumpist, I'm hiding my Trumpism and I'm gonna sit there and never gonna vote for conviction. What do you think?
I want Emily to remind us what the standard is for jurors, because it's not that they've never had a thought ever. But just quickly, I'll interject, Ricky Kleeman, who's a CBS legal analyst who's picked juries in New York, said that what she always looked for in these instances was not somebody who was pure as the driven snow, but somebody who was hiding inside them a kind of, they would say all the right things out loud, but hiding inside them the delight at being involved in a high profile trial, and like had their own sense of what they might do with the information, write a book later or whatever, because they would be, highly unpredictable and perhaps, inspired to do crazy things in the process of thinking through the case.
I was thinking about that for obviously lots of people, it'd be incredibly appealing to be on this jury. And all you have to do is look a little bit like, as long as you don't have a public record on social media of having either praised or castigated Donald Trump, then you can hide what's in your heart. You don't have to tell them what you really think. And that's the kind of art and or dark art of jury selection is that the prosecutors, the defense lawyers, the judge, they can ask a lot of questions of the jurors to try to determine fairness. But for the most part, it's up to the jurors to answer the question. And I've been struck by how candid I think a lot of them have been about whether or not they could be fair. The question is whether one person gets smuggled in or two people who are, you know, hiding some bias they have. But I guess to take a step back, I mean, I have always been skeptical of the idea that we are better off with jurors who know nothing about major news events. I just don't understand why we think that's like a good way to go about picking a jury. We want people who are informed and nobody has zero opinions. The question is, can you set aside what you already know to look at the facts that are going to be presented to you in court anew? And can you make your decision based on those facts? And I think lots of people can do that. They can have ideas about someone or something, but then do a really rigorous job in their heads of kind of scrubbing that away for purposes of rendering a verdict.
I mean, obviously none of the three of us would be let near that jury, not because we're not fair-minded people, but because each of us has written so much and said so many things about politics, and no, there's no chance that either, you know, prosecutors or defense attorneys would let us near there. So I think it's a hypothetical question. I'm hypothetically in the January 6th jury pool. John is like not in the New York jury pool, but could have been. But do you guys think you could be fair to Trump, honestly, in your heart of hearts? I think I could be. I think I would be a perfectly good. In fact, I think I would be fairer to him than, yes, I would be to some politician I agreed with more, because I would want to go out of my way to make sure that the system is working fairly. And I know I'm just deluding myself, but I really think that I would serve on a jury like that and be like, yeah, I can listen to this and hear it. Not that they let me on, as I said.
Well, I mean, yeah, also you're professionally trained to determine whether the claim a person is making is supported by the work that they've done to support that claim, both as a journalist evaluating other people and as an editor evaluating the argument the writers make. So if the essence of a jury trial is to make a claim and then marshal evidence that supports that claim, you would be falling right into what you've done your whole career in deciding whether they met the standard. So it seems like you would, I don't think what you've said is contraindicated by your life's experience.
Emily, there was much glee in some circles when Maggie Haberman of the New York Times reported that Trump fell asleep during some of the initial hearings, and a lot of joking about, oh, who's the real sleepy candidate here? And look, I mean, again, who among us has not fallen asleep in a stuffy, boring proceeding? I will excuse the former president on that grounds. But do you feel like it's a bummer not to have cameras in the courtroom for this? Or do you think it would just clownify and circusify the spectacle?
That's such a good question. I mean, for Supreme Court and appellate proceedings, I'm all for cameras. In trials, it does, you know, obviously amp up the impulse to kind of entertain. And I think Trump would be behaving really differently. On the other hand, I just do feel like, as you started the segment by saying, this is a really important moment for American democracy. And so in that sense, the idea that we can't just watch it seems kind of wrong, right? Like, we should be able to judge for ourselves by seeing the demeanor of the witnesses, seeing how Trump is responding, seeing how the judge is acting, and putting a veil between us and that proceeding seems really unfortunate. In some states, this would be televised.
I'm kind of glad it's not televised, because it would encourage Trump to act out even more. And I think, by the way, the whole he fell asleep glee thing is stupid. It's just like totally dumb and often a symptom of Trump derangement syndrome. But let's think about just for a moment what Trump does say out loud at the barriers when he comes out of the courtroom. Because I was struck, we all know that Trump has made a career out of lying. And we saw him in his presidency lie, and his second or his third presidential campaign is founded around the lie that the election was stolen. We know all of that. But these court appearances create an ongoing condition of constant lies and falsehood. And I wonder about that as being a new kind of Trump lying. Because, I mean, when a person is known to drink from a cup and then moves to a condition where they're actually bathing neck deep in what they used to drink, I think that is a new thing. And he is just constantly lying when he comes out about what the case is about his behavior, about what the judge is claiming. CBS has a new thing called CBS Confirms, which is a fact-checking organization. And they went through all of the various lies that he has told and that have been picked up. And I think this conditions him as a human to be in a state, these cases do, of a of constantly lying, even more than he did previously, and conditions his party to accept those lies and be fine with those lies and allow those lies. And we should also note that this is a party that once put personal morality at the center of a presidential election and is now not batting an eye at the specifics of the case. The fact he's been accused by 26 women, has been liable for sexual assault, is on tape bragging about the joys of sexual assault, is a known adulterer. Why does that matter? It's not just mere hypocrisy. It is a part of this conditioning I'm trying to identify here, which means that when and if he were in office, he has now been even further conditioned to constant mistruths, and all those surrounding him have become even more pliable in allowing those to go forward. And I think that is what we see day by day at the end of the day, each time he comes out and says things that are just totally disconnected from the facts.
Well, one hopes that the courtroom and the strictures of the courtroom and the strictures of the legal system is at one place where those lies don't find purchase. They are not allowed to find purchase. One hopes that he just can't lie his way through this.
Right. But then the real danger is, what if the suppleness and the being okay with lies actually infects the view about the legal system? In other words, they just, the people who've been conditioned by all of this behavior decide that the legal system isn't legitimate anymore.
I want to give a huge thank you to our Slate Plus listeners. You have supported us. It's helped us keep the show going for so long. You get so much great stuff for your subscription, bonus segments on every episode of the Gabfest and other Slate podcasts, discounts to live shows, no hitting the paywall on the Slate site. And this week for our Slate Plus segment, it's sort of insider Slate Plus. We're going to be talking about death, sex, and money. Or actually, we'll be talking to Anna Sale, the host of the best named podcast of all time, Death, Sex, and Money, about the subjects of death, sex, and money. Death, sex, and money has just joined the Slate family. And so now Anna is a Slate brethren of ours, sister of ours. And we're excited to welcome her to the Slate family and to hear more about that podcast, which is one of the treasures of the podcasting world. So if you are a member, thank you. Enjoy it. If you're not, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today and hear our conversation with Anna Sale. Supreme Court heard arguments this week in another case. All we do is talk about legal stuff. Another case that has huge Trump criminal implications involving a January 6th insurrectionist, Joseph Fisher, who was an off-duty cop from Pennsylvania, charged with multiple counts for his appalling behavior at the Capitol, including assaulting police officers. At issue is one charge of the seven he faced, that he obstructed an official proceeding. He claims that the law he's charged under, which is U.S. Code 1512C, Section 2, does not refer to actions like invading the Capitol, but only concerns things like the destruction of documents and evidence that would might be presented to Congress and are distorted or ruined because you have changed them. The Fisher case is important because there are 350 January 6th defendants who have been similarly charged with obstruction, and that Donald Trump, two of the charges he faces are for January 6th. Two of the four charges he faces for January 6th are obstruction, although Emily will disaggregate them because it's slightly different terms. So, Emily, I'm going to read the statute at issue here. Whoever corruptly, number one, alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a record, document, or other object, or attempts to do so with the intent to impair the object's integrity or availability in an official proceeding, or two, otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding or attempts to do so, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both. So what is the legal issue here, Emily? Otherwise.
So, yes, this is a question of statutory construction. We have two parts. They say either this or otherwise that. Does otherwise, is it necessarily limited by the content of the first provision? In other words, in this case, it would need to have something to do with destroying, mutilating, or concealing a record, otherwise destroying a record, or is otherwise just saying otherwise obstructing, influencing, or preceding any official proceeding in a way that can have nothing to do with the records part of the first clause, which is the more natural reading. You could ask what Congress intended. Some of the Supreme Court justices are more interested in that than others. And what we had here was conservative justices expecting a great deal of skepticism that otherwise could have a kind of broad meaning. They want to very tightly anchor this otherwise clause to the first part so that in a situation where you don't have anything about destroying a document, that's not what you're really talking about at all, you can't bring charges under this statute.
Emily, is the reading of the notion, the conservative reading of this, which is that the second part there otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes, that that's essentially saying we've tried to fully define what a record, how destroying a record can be defined. But if anybody tries to define destroying a record in any other way, that's also captured in the statute. Is that what they assume the intent of the legislative writers is?
Yeah. And I think that would be super obvious if the one and the two were in different places, right? So like if you had corruptly alters, destroys, blah, 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 and then it said one, you know, with intent to impair the object's integrity, or two, otherwise obstructs, then you would know that the whole clause was governed by this records part. But that's not what it says, right? It says one thing and then the other thing. And so there truly is, I think, ambiguity about this.
Although destroying, altering, and mutilating are three pretty, I mean, like what else could you do to a document that hasn't been cabined by that definition?
Right. And then that would be the argument for the broader reading that Congress is trying to say. I'm also talking about all these other ways of obstructing of an official proceeding. And that's what Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor were basically arguing.
To me, the most extraordinary fact in this is one that I haven't heard discussed much at all. So this was a law that's passed in the wake of the Enron scandal, when Enron or people connected with Enron are accused of doing exactly this to documents they were supposed to present to Congress. So that's the context. Is there really no law in the United States against obstructing an official proceeding? Until this moment, was there no law which said, oh, if I go in to the Capitol and, you know, I cut all the mics and I hold all the members of Congress hostage, that is not a crime? I mean, there are crimes that I'm committing in the context of doing it, like the holding the hostage, but that the act of disrupting what the U.S. government is doing is not a crime. That, to me, it was extraordinary to find out that there is nothing in the U.S. code that bars people from trying to prevent the government from doing its work.
Same. Yes. And then that's why I was drawn to the argument, or to a point that Justice Kagan made, which was like, wait a second, Congress was trying to fill in some gaps here. Let's think about the gaps they were trying to fill in. Of course, another way to think, David, about why we wouldn't want a whole lot of those laws is we want to make sure that people have plenty of room to protest and have speech that's disruptive. And so, I mean, one of the sort of wonderful ironies of oral argument this week was the great concern that Justice Alito was professing for people doing sit-ins. Justice Gorsuch was worried about, what if you want to pull the fire alarm? Could you get prosecuted? There was a lot of real concern for civil disobedience and protest going on among conservatives, and things were feeling a little bit upside down.
Well, it was an amazing argument because it feels like there are literally in the nine justices, four different factions. There's the kind of Roberts, who seems to be reading it like the way Joseph Fisher wants to read it, which is that the text is means is just has to do with documents. And so Fisher is off the hook because this has nothing to do with documents. That's Roberts. And maybe Gorsuch was along with that. Then
Kavanaugh.
There's like, and then Barrett and Jackson are saying, okay, it's textually vague, but maybe the January 6th people, what they're doing still qualified because maybe they're preventing it from getting to Mike Pence's desk. Or if the vote is taking place with paperwork on Mike Pence's desk, maybe that's a document that is it being that's a
messed
integrity
with.
That's been messed with. Then there's like Sotomayor and Kagan, who are saying the text of the law is pretty clear, otherwise obstructing and influencing and impeding, like when you invade the Capitol and assault cops and, you know, prevent Senate from doing its work, you're obviously doing that. And then Well, so Kavanaugh seemed to actually occupy a slightly different face, which is that he's already facing six other serious felony charges. What is the point of, like, this one seems additive, pointlessly additive and ambiguous. And so why are we piling this on when he's going to go to prison?
Which that was kind of hilarious to me. Yeah. Well, he was like, well, aren't you just throwing this in here because it has a 20-year maximum sentence? And so it really ups the punishment. And the government was like, oh, no, not that's the reason. Of course, that's the reason. Like, that's what prosecutors do all the time. I liked the idea that that was a problem, actually.
But when they're evaluating things, are they supposed to do that? I mean, obviously, they're supposed to look at the facts of the case. But on the other hand, if this is a constitutional question or a statutory interpretation question, does the manner in which it's being applied in that context matter to divining whether the law says what they claim that it says it does?
I mean, I think it's really bad to just mount up the ante of charging to up the sure. punishment to force people to plea bargain, but I don't know yeah. why it's unconstitutional, unfortunately, right. or why it's at odds with the text of this statute.
Also, back to your point, David, about the idea that maybe there was an actual document here. It seems that if you were looking for support of the argument that destruction of a document can be defined super broadly, I mean, there presumably the vote is a document of sorts. Somebody must write it down somewhere. And so if you were trying to look for a statute that defined all manner of human behavior as possibly interfering with a document, in other words, human behavior that was something more than altering, destroying, or mutilate, well, I've got the statute for right. you. Because right. it's saying basically any other possible way. So you perform a Baroque ballet that keeps the document from getting certified. Well, then that is a sufficient trigger for the statute. I mean, obviously, I'm being absurd. But on the other hand, I don't know.
I mean, there was a conceals. There was this talk that they were going to actually steal the ballots so that they couldn't vote, right? So that would be concealing. That was an attempt to conceal. And Emily, isn't it also the case that when it comes to the Trump obstruction charges, which we haven't talked about, one of them is about the fake elector scheme. And I presume a fake elector scheme would potentially fall, even no matter how you read this law, would potentially fall under it because it would intrinsically involve submitting some sort of document that is altered or misleading, right?
Yeah. I mean, the Justice Department, in considering this argument in the context of the case against Trump, is saying we should be able to bring this charge even if there's a narrow statutory definition that limits it to documents for the very reason you said. The fake elector scheme is itself all about altering, concealing, destroying documents. It'll be interesting to see if that sticks. Just to be clear, Trump is facing other charges, conspiracy charges that overlap with this obstruction of an official proceeding charge and are independent of it. But again, the amount of prison time he could very theoretically serve is vastly increased by bringing these obstruction of an official proceeding charges.
Do you guys think that Alito and Thomas are on to something when they say that it is dangerous to have this on the books because there's the potential that you have a code pink activist who yells at a congressional hearing and is facing 20 years in prison, or somebody who stands up at a Supreme Court and disrupts a Supreme Court argument for 3 minutes and they are facing 20 years in prison, that in the hands of a prosecutor that has a political agenda, that this is a dangerous law?
It could be. I was pretty persuaded by Justice Barrett's, you know, seeming response to that, which was to talk about free speech rights in the First Amendment, that they could come into play in the context of that kind of enforcement of the law. I mean, also, you don't normally decide that you can't apply a criminal statute in one context because there is a kind of slippery slope that you're talking about with lots of other things that are pretty unrelated and much more minor and de minimis in their sort of, you know, in the scenario you're playing out. Like, that was just a weird idea to me. And so it all felt a little bit like a big red herring. Though I just saw the movie Civil War, which I might talk about a little bit later. And like, anything that makes the government seem more powerful seems bad. So I did have a moment of being drawn to that. Like, oh no, don't give them this tool.
Can I ask one question that takes us back to our first topic, which is, David, you said at the start that the hush money trial may be the only one that goes to trial. Can you just tell me what your thinking is on the Smith case on election interference with Trump? Is your assumption that basically the Supreme Court takes so long that the case never gets before Judge Chutkan, or that something else happens?
Well, presumably the Supreme Court won't issue a ruling in this till they don't hear it till the end of this month, right? And they are presumably next will not week. Issue a ruling until
the end know, of when? June.
The end of June, right? And so then Chutkan has to sort of gear everything up and get everything going. I mean, that's
and there could be other challenges. I think right. most people who are following this case think it's very unlikely to go to trial before the election. Like people in the Justice Department.
But I guess I'm trying to help people understand the specifics of that, where they see the delay. Like, is it that the Supreme Court takes its sweet time and we don't? Or is it that because Chutkan has said there's going to be a 2 month prep period once the clock gets to start ticking again, which presumably would come after the Supreme Court ruling, or that because Trump has a whole history of delaying at every possible turn, that even if the clock starts ticking again and you could have a trial that starts in late September, early October, that the sufficient number of delay tactics could take you past November? Like what the specific reasons are for the delay?
I mean, it's all of the above. And the closer you get to the election, the more there is just a question of basic fairness about whether a presidential candidate should be sitting trial in the month, you know, a few weeks before the election.
Gavin Newsom Can't Help Himself is a profile of the California governor by Mark Leibovich in The Atlantic. Mark, welcome back to my home office where we're in kissing distance.
It's amazing how close we are, David.
We're sharing a microphone. We're sharing earbuds.
You should, yeah. Should we talk about the history of our closeness?
We're nuzzling.
Our platonic closeness.
No, let's not. Let's not do that.
But to help viewers understand, imagine if the two of you had to do this for an entire day, stay at that distance connected by earbuds. It would be like one of you would have to piggyback on the other.
We've done that. Yeah. So, Mark, you have profiled a lot of politicians, including a lot of white dude politicians. It's one of your specialties.
You know, I have a bad rap about that, but it's true. A lot of them are white dudes.
Is Gavin Newsom remarkable? Is he a generational talent?
He kind of comes close up to that at times. He is also an extremely big, he's a very talented surrogate for Joe Biden. He's a very talented politician, but he has some real can't help himself, some would say self-destructive streaks. And one of them is, you know, he wants to please everyone at all times, including, you know, profile writers and who want to spend time with him when at a time when perhaps it's in his best interest to keep a lower national profile in the service to what his main goal is, he says, which is to be the super surrogate for Joe Biden in somewhat edgy media environments like Real Time with Bill Maher or Fox News or Republican spin rooms, things like that. I mean, he's one of the very few Democratic politicians who is, I think, nimble enough to go into those lion's dens and actually make a case in more contentious settings. But Gavin Newsom, who I've known a long time, but I haven't interviewed him in a long time, he's very compelling, but he's also, he'll just say things that he probably shouldn't say, and the results of which are in the aforementioned profile in The Atlantic this week.
What were the things he said to you that you were like, ooh, that's really not in your interest? Just sitting for the profile at all?
Yeah, well, that was interesting. I mean, I assumed he was going to, in a very kind of friendly, sheepish way, say, no, this is bad for me. And he essentially did, but he did it over 2 months and after Biden clinched the nomination and he was through the State of the Union, Gavin figured it was safe. I assume he checked with the White House, the reelect, something. And next thing, you know, I'm there in his office in Sacramento a few weeks ago. So, you know, we were talking about the extremely familiar topic of what about Biden's age? Biden's age seems to be his intractable problem. I mean, yes, his approval numbers are what they are. His head-to-head numbers against Trump are what they are. But if you look at survey after survey, including among Democrats and independents, just an overwhelming majority of Americans do not want him running for president at this age. That has been true for 2 years now. And, you know, that ship is sailed because he's won the nomination, he's running, and people are, you know, Democrats are hopefully getting in line behind him. But Newsom, in answering that question or sort of talking on that theme, as he has millions of times before, I put the question to him, just like I said. I said, isn't age the intractable issue for Joe Biden? And Newsom said, well, yeah, maybe not. Maybe there's that Prevagen thing. I'm like, what? Prevagen is I guess it's a extract that they advertise on Fox News, which he watches a lot of, that can apparently reverse the aging process. I mean, it seems completely I was not familiar with it, but he starts talking about Prevagen. I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, well, isn't that thing on Fox where you can reverse the aging process or something like that? And I said, very deadpan, you know, have you thought about talking to the Biden campaign about the president maybe going on a more vigorous regimen of Prevagen or something? And I was being funny. He played along. He laughed. He then dissembled and he said, well, I was trying to be funny and trying to make the point that I've made this point a million times before. So, yes, he's trying to be interesting. He can't help himself. He needs to be interesting. And I have a nice little scene that became kind of the end of the lead of the story. And that is an example of him not being able to help himself. There are many other episodes of that happening through the piece, which, you know, again, sort of speak to that theme of him not being able to help himself.
What's lovely about that theme and that headline is it's not only can he not help himself, he steps on his shoelaces or whatever this is a description of, but he also can't help himself to the extent that his ambition is the White House, and he can't help himself because he has a candidate in the way. I mean, so he can only do so much. And so implicit in that is what I'll just ask, which is it obvious that he wants to be president someday?
Yes, it is obvious to me. I mean, you know, it's not unique among ambitious young politicians who are under the age of 85, or maybe it's under 90 now. But yes, he wants to run for president. I mean, one of the interesting themes that he kind of pivoted to is talking about the power of maturity and having older mentors, as he has throughout his political life. Jerry Brown, who he had a very fraught relationship with, but the longtime multi-governor of California, he was Jerry Brown's lieutenant governor for 8 years. Willie Brown, the kind of legendary mayor of San Francisco, assembly. You know,
Jim Brown.
Not Jim Brown.
Yes, there exactly. Some non-Browns there.
Now, Nancy Pelosi. I mean, there were a lot of others. And he now put Biden in that category. He says that he's developed a closeness to Joe Biden and blah, blah, blah. But ultimately, you know, yes, maybe Biden's an example of maturity and leading by experience and temperance and everything. Biden is also standing in the way. And, you know, I think like a lot of Democrats, whether they will say this in public or not, he was sort of expecting that Biden would be a president who would get out of the way, sooner than he is going to.
But has Newsom been a good or admired governor of California? I have no real sense of it. He's obviously really good on TV and he's, you know, will show up and debate Ron DeSantis and so forth. But do the people of California think, wow, our state is better, he's really led us well, or is it not so much?
Largely. I mean, he has, a huge institutional advantage, which is a deep blue state. And he is a Democratic kind of base-friendly governor. And, you know, in the spirit of him stepping on it, I mean, he went to this, he had this fiasco in 2020, where he went to this fancy dinner at the French Laundry in Napa, which is a really fancy restaurant. And it was, it ran him afoul of state COVID regulations. I mean, he was one of those politicians who had one of those stories attached to him. The far right kind of, you know, picked this up and they launched a recall campaign against him, which is very easy to do in California. And all of a sudden, you know, when just in this day and age, when you have the backing of, you know, I doubt, you know, there may be 35-40% of California who's hardcore Republican, then you have Fox, you know, he had to run for his political life and sort of withstand this recall campaign. But I mean, yes, I would say so. He was overwhelmingly reelected. I mean, he's done a lot of kind of aspirational things, like said, you know, by 2035, we want to, I might be getting the numbers wrong, but we want to, you know, eliminate carbon emissions by this very, very dramatic degree. We want to make California an abortion sanctuary, you know, in a country where abortion is becoming really precarious in many states. So things that are very pleasing to, you know, certainly to a national audience, but, you know, to your basic, you know, pro-choice voter, which is an overwhelming majority of California. I mean, he said things that are very pleasing. But yeah, I mean, you know, the economy's done okay. I mean, there are a lot of things that people point to that are troubling indicators, like people leaving California. Although I drove in from Palo Alto to Sacramento in the morning, and I said sarcastically, I said, Governor, there was no traffic here. It was, and by the way, the mountains were beautiful and like green. I mean, so one, there's no drought, and two, the fact that everyone's leaving eliminates the traffic problem. So I was being kind of a wise ass, and he goes, oh, you're going there immediately, are you? I can assure you there are terrible traffic problems there. So again, he defended himself in kind of a counterintuitive, interesting way, saying basically, we have a lot of traffic here.
I was thinking about whether, in fact, he was totally helping himself with this profile in this sense. Like, did he thread the needle? He put himself back on the radar of Democrats nationally who are reading your story, right? I mean, I hadn't thought about him for a while. And he, you know, was also being pretty careful to be super respectful of Biden and make it clear that he was not jumping in front. And he was trying, in fact, to be, like you said, the super surrogate. It's sort of, and he had to keep it a little bit interesting or else you weren't going to be there, right? Like, or it was going to be a kind of, you know, fallen souffle of a profile. So I guess I was wondering in the end if like he can help himself and he kind of did help himself and there was like some amount of risk in that, but mostly he sort of pulled it off.
Yeah. You know what? I don't know. I don't know what his calculations were. I don't know what the, I haven't heard from him at all. I have not heard from the White House. I have not heard from him or anyone in his orbit. I mean, it's kind of a perfect react so far, which is that readers seem to like it. You know, there were no, no crises around it yet. You know, look, I think right now we are in a media just deluge where, you know, this profile over here, unless something goes really off the rails. I mean, look, there are some Democratic insider types who said, okay, there's an oppo opportunity for anyone running against him in 2028 in about five different places in that. I'm like, okay, well, that's the world you live in, but I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. But I don't know. Look, it's profiles, as everyone on certainly in this conversation knows, are very, very fraught for everyone involved. You never know how they're going to go. They're not all, I mean, there's just like this big kind of transference around them. I mean, it's just people have calculations and feelings and perceptions and self-consciousness. And I include the writer in this very much, me in this case. And you just don't know how it's all going to come out. And that's sort of like this big, grand, weird experiment that these things are. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of words are on the page and people read them and we go on to the next thing.
Mark, I want to go back to something that's universal in politicians that Newsom demonstrated, which you already touched on a little bit, which is the universal desire to be loved. One of the things that's always interested me about that is obviously Donald Trump does not have that desire and yet has it, as he would say, strongly. And it's marbleized through him. It's usually pretty obvious with politicians that even that they used to say about Bill Clinton, you know, that he would find the one person in the room who disagreed with him and then try and convince them that that's why they should agree with him or they should like him. I then would like to now ask the question, which is, do you see the exchange you had with Newsom about Donald Trump and not having talked to him since whatever the last time was before the 2020 election in that same category that he kind of wants connection with Trump in some way that might be inconsistent with the current state of the Democratic Party, which sees Trump as a, you know, figure to be never to talk to.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very rich point there. I mean, I think that it's very, very counterintuitive, but you mentioned, okay, first of all, Bill Clinton is, I would say, a top two or three idol of Gavin Newsom's. He loves Bill Clinton. He loved him in the 90s. They have a relationship. He loves like the whole Clinton thing. And, you know, the pleasing instinct has been there for a long time and also sort of threaded through a political, you know, in a context. I mean, Clinton really is someone he quotes a lot. He thinks about a lot. I think he talks to him a lot too, or has over the years. As for Trump, yeah, I was shocked. I mean, yes, Trump is a all-purpose boogeyman for a ambitious Democrat or any Democrat. And, you know, for good reason. He has a lot of fodder. I think Newsom has genuine revulsion to much of what Trump stands for. But there was, as the story talks about, there was this weird symbiosis between the two of them when, especially around 2020, when there were these terrible wildfires in California, COVID was happening. The two of them were talking a lot. Newsom was praising Trump more strategically than almost any other Democrat. It actually got a lot for California, a lot of like 100% reimbursement around COVID, federal aid around some of the disasters, you know, far more than what some of the Republican states were getting. And the two of them are not completely dissimilar. I mean, they are both showmen. Trump is extremely needy. I mean, he's unconfrontational often. He wants everyone to like him. He, like Clinton, like Newsom, like a lot of people, wants to please the person in the room. Another thing I didn't mention, but I mean, both Newsom and Trump come from hospitality backgrounds. Newsom was a restaurant and bar owner. Trump, and people don't talk about this a lot, but he was a hotel. You know, he's got all these golf clubs, everything. The time I spent around Trump, like back in 2015, 2016, what I was always shocked by is any setting you go with him, he acts like the maitre d'. It's like, are you okay here? Are you comfortable here? Like, there was an experience I had where that ill-fated hosting of Saturday Night Live in 2015, I happened to be there that night for a long story. After party, we're in this restaurant 4 a.m, and Trump and his entire family are there, and Bill O'Reilly for some reason, and the Saturday Night Live cast. It was just a surreal setting. And I'm sitting at this table, and it was just, again, bizarre. And Lorne Michaels was there. And Trump keeps coming over, leaving his table with his family, talking to me and a couple of other people, saying, you guys okay? Are they taking care of you here? And he would turn to the waiter or the waitress saying, hey, make sure you take care of these people. And I'm like, dude, this is not your restaurant. I mean, turn off like the – but his instinct is to be the hospitable guy. Newsom, same way. He said when I talked about – he was the history of his relationship with Biden would say, yeah, Biden would come to my restaurants in like the 80s and 90s when he was raising money. And, you know, I hosted him in the restaurant. And he always seemed to have a good time and we had a good rapport. So there's a real overlap there. So, yes, there was a symbiosis. And then, you know, Trump loses the election. Newsom reaches out to him, I guess, to console him. And Trump stops returning his calls immediately. And, you know, you'd think Trump was obviously in a very addled state after the election. And, you know, you'd think that he's not going to be returning some Democrat in California's calls. But Newsom, even in talking to him now about it, seemed somewhat, you know, a little snubbed by this, a little hurt. And, you know, here we are a few years later, and there's a lot more going on.
Mark Leibovich's Atlantic piece on Gavin Newsom. Gavin Newsom can't help himself. Mark, thanks for coming on the Gabfest, and thanks for literally breathing all over me.
Yeah,
for the last 12 minutes.
But so do I. Am I dismissed now? I have my. You're Dunkin'
dismissed.
I have my Dunkin' Donuts coffee. All right, guys. Hey, thanks.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. Gavin Newsom has a winery, the Plump Jack Winery. That's the name of his winery. So when you're sitting and sipping on a delightful glass of Plump Jack, Emily, what are you going to be chattering about?
I have two chatters. The first one is, if you've been following the story about Uri Berliner, the NPR editor who criticized NPR and was suspended and now has resigned, I recommend a story by Alicia Montgomery, who's the vice president for podcasts at Slate. It's called The Real Story Behind NPR's Current Problems. I just thought it was really useful to read in thinking about all this. I have really no informed opinion about what it's like to work at NPR. Just a lot of feelings as a listener. And, you know, it was just helped me in getting a kind of fuller picture of what it is actually like to work there. And from Alicia's perspective, what the kind of main and enduring problems there are. And second, I saw the movie Civil War over the weekend, and I had kind of two reactions to it. One was that it really reminded me of the TV show The Last of Us, in the sense that it's like this tour through an American dystopia with these different incidents. And I think the appeal of these shows right now is you just like try to think, what would you do? It's like familiar enough and completely horrifying at the same time that you can't help but trying to put yourself in the shoes of the characters. And I guess that was especially true this time because the characters are journalists. And I found myself really bridling at some of the portrayal of the journalists. Some of it worked for me, like the level of intensity and then the kind of like needing to let off steam afterward, the kind of weird laughter at moments where like something really violent had just happened. Like that all I thought landed. But there's this idea in the beginning, the main character says, like, I went and I took all these pictures of terrible things in foreign countries so that we would make sure this doesn't happen here. And like, I don't think that's why photojournalists do their work in foreign countries. They do that mostly because we're trying to understand those places, not necessarily to think about ourselves. And then I just found the portrayal of the distancing so extreme, the emotional distancing and the idea that like the way to do this is to just be completely cold and clinical about it. And I don't want to spoil the movie, but it really goes to quite an extreme place. I just don't think that's how most of us operate. I mean, I am not a foreign war correspondent, but I think most people, it's harder and there's more gray area and just more like human foibles and shortcomings, rather than this like very cold ideal that was being kind of put forward.
Can you tell people what the movie's about briefly?
Yeah, I mean, it's about a civil war in America. So it's not clear why it has broken out exactly, except there's a president who's having a third term. That's evident in the first few minutes. And different territories of the United States are trying to overthrow the American government. And these journalists are on a trip down the Eastern Seaboard to try to get to Washington, D.C. in the midst and this at a key moment in the conflict.
John, what's your chatter?
I have three mini chatters. The first is the... you know, when we talk about abortion rights policy, I always want to look at how the treatment of children in those states overlaps with their abortion policy. And the Annie Casey Foundation does a lot of study along this route, which is to say, what opportunities are there and how are children taken care of and treated in various states? And now something's just been published called the Child Opportunity Index, from diversitydatakids.org project at Brandeis University, which just adds more data to this and goes into localities where kids have the most opportunity. Bridgeport, Connecticut, Emily, your state of Connecticut, San Jose, California, Boston have the highest overall opportunity score. McAllen, Texas, and Brownsville, Texas have lower ones. And one of the factors they talk about is opportunity hoarding, which Anna was discussing a little bit in terms of generational wealth. So it's worth checking out if you're interested in that. The other is that we didn't talk about this in politics, but something was happening with the Biden campaign this week that was kind of a throwback to the way campaigns used to be held. Biden was in Philadelphia talking about tax rates and Pittsburgh talking about steel tariffs he wants to slap on the Chinese for dumping steel and for trying to basically take over the shipbuilding industry. He was at a union hall. It was basically old-fashioned politics where you announce policy in places where the voters are you're trying to get. And it'll be fascinating at the end of the election, depending on how it turns out, if that kind of politics you would have expected from like the 90s still exists in this world where so much is taken over by social media and what appears on cable and all of that. So if there's a week you want to look at where there's like very old-fashioned style politics, in a battleground state, that was what was taking place with the Biden campaign in this week. And then final personal log rolling. You think I'm going to pitch you on listening to Navel Gazing, but you're not entirely true. Of course, I'm going to do that. I am on the 22nd of April, moving from 7 p.m. to 6 p.m. CBS News primetime is turning into CBS News The Daily Report, which will be a 90-minute show. It's starting up only as an hour at 6 p.m. So, orient your lives accordingly, but also for a little while, and now I'm undermining my own pitch, it's going to be repeated again at 7. So you can tune in at 6 or tune in at 7. Of course, make sure you listen to Navel Gazing. A new episode is out. A third episode is out for regular listeners on Saturday, plus listeners get both the third and the fourth episode.
My chatter is about a fascinating new podcast, which dropped on Audible, only on Audible for the moment. It's called Hold Fast. It was brought to my attention by Sam Eifling, who's a reporter, writer who's done some work for Slate in the past. Sam, like the other two creators of this podcast, worked for the New Times empire. The New Times was this alt-weekly empire in the 90s and 2000s, built by two extremely charismatic and contentious men, Mike Lacy and Jim Larkin. And they built this alt-weekly empire, very successful, ultimately encompassed the Village Voice, sold it, made a lot of money. Then Lacey and Larkin, as they were known, Lacey and Larkin went and founded Backpage, which became the sex worker site, the place for sex advertisement. And that was ultimately shut down by the feds. And they were both indicted and I think both convicted, certainly. Mike Lacy was convicted for abetting prostitution and I think for child endangerment. And there's now a podcast about this, their rise and fall. And I've only listened to the first episode. It is a fascinating story, just fascinating. And Mike Lacy, who's the protagonist of it, who's very much on interview and at the center of it, is a really interesting person to listen to. And he's a deeply complicated people. I was kind of on the periphery of the New Times world because I worked in alt weeklies. I worked in a separate chain of alt weeklies. But my mentors were people who kind of had the same cavalier, bravado, ambitious, fearless fuck you spirit as Lacy and Larkin did. But Lacy and Larkin like went in this direction, which took them into terrible criminal places. So anyway, hold fast on Audible. It's off to a great start. Listeners, you also have chatters. Please keep them coming to us by emailing us at gabfest@slate.com. What you're talking about at your cocktail party when you're having a glass of Plump Jack wine. And our listener chatter this week is from Josh from Brisbane, Australia. Hello, Josh.
Hey, Gabfest. My chatter is the uphill legal battle being attempted by Ross Scott. Ross is trying to save video games from being destroyed. Apart from being one of the newest and fastest spreading art forms, video games also operate within one of the least consumer-friendly industries of the modern world. Ross is using the destruction of the video game The Crew by Ubisoft as a way to test the legality of the anti-consumer grey area that video game publishers have been abusing for decades. Ross is taking charge on a global effort to protect games. Ross's website, StopKillingGames.com, is an easy-to-use site for gamers across the world to unite and help the fight to stop the destruction of video games. Even if you don't game yourself, please check his website out. It's an interesting read just to see how bad the consumer protections are for video games, not only in the US, but around the world. Thanks. Love the show.
That's our show for today. The Political Gabfest is produced by Shana Roth. Our researcher is Julie Hugin. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations, Alicia Montgomery, in addition to writing articles that Emily is chattering about as the VP of Audio for Slate. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We will talk to you next week. Hi, Slate Plus. How are you? Good. We have a very special guest, our new sibling at Slate, Anna Sale. Anna is the creator and host of Death, Sex, and Money, which is one of the great podcasts of the world. It is also, Anna, the best named podcast of all time. And you've recently had an experience with death, or with death and money, I guess, which is that your Death, Sex, and Money was killed by its owner, WNYC, then bought, and then it was bought for, I assume, money by Slate, and now it's back alive at Slate, and you've just relaunched it. So congratulations.
That's right. Also sex, kind of, because we had a rebirth, maybe. Yes.
No immaculate conception.
A lot of that just happened all in the last 6 months.
If you have a resurrection, you have to have an immaculate conception.
It could be parthogenesis. It just like butted off. So I think most people who listen to the Gabfest probably know what Death, Sex, and Money is. So I'm going to assume a certain level of knowledge, but I want to, you can fight that by explaining it if you want. But you started Death, Sex, and Money when you were in your 30s. And I actually find that interesting because you're only in your early 40s now. And I think now that I'm in my 50s, I think you kind of have to take a battering to be willing to talk about death, sex, and money. I feel like starting that podcast in your 30s is remarkable, because I think when people are in their 30s and even into their 40s, like there's so much fronting, there's so much like presenting an image to the world, that it's hard. It's even harder. It gets easier as you get older. And so I was wondering how you felt about having those conversations when you were so young. I imagine your peers didn't want to have those conversations.
Oh, I really love this question. You're positing that you have to go through some kind of humiliation to be able to talk publicly about death, sex, and money. And I think that might be right. Like, you have to be thrown off your game to be willing to sort of dive in. And maybe I was young, but I was also divorced. So I got divorced when I was 31. And I think that was like a really important thing that happened as I was coming up with the idea of death, sex, and money, because it was kind of an early middle age experience of having my life upended. What I thought was going to happen, how I thought it was going to look, fell apart. And then I just was in this desperate search for guides about how to rebuild. And so that was kind of how I think about the early years of the show, was just me wanting to not just like get life advice, but also I wanted to compare notes with people to feel less alone about having had that experience of having something fall apart that I thought was going to endure.
That makes sense to me, because I feel like the qualities of your show that strike me the most are the curiosity and the humility in it. And it plays out because you talk to a lot of like ordinary, regular people, as well as, you know, someone who's pitching a book or has like some, you know, more kind of fame or profession driven claim on audiences. And I wonder just how you think about that balance in your show. Like, you seem to be really interested in your listeners, getting them to come on and like respond to questions. I just wonder how you think about it. Is that a division that you even think about? Maybe that's not how you conceive of it.
I mean, it becomes a division when I have to come up with like marketing language to explain the right show, you know, but I think my journalistic curiosity has always included that because of my roots as a politics reporter. You know, I had to cover elected officials and people who were running for office. And then I also was talking with voters all the time. And where those two kind of different sorts of interviews were out of sync were really interesting to me, you know, like, and then I found more and more that the voter conversations were felt more honest. They felt more textured. They felt deeper. And so then I started thinking, like, what would it be like if I talked to public people with the same sorts of questions that I ask voters about? And when I say voter interviews, I mean the sorts of conversations where you're like, how are things going in your life? Are things going in the right direction or wrong direction? You know, that sort of thing. And so I don't really think of it as all that different. I'm just like, I want to know. and I also want to know, as far as with listeners, I think as a journalist, I always want to be, make sure I'm hearing how our work is being consumed, kind of, and whether it's hitting the mark and where people are hearing our blind spots. And so I think that's part of where we just got really interested in asking listeners really open questions, because I wanted to know what they were bringing to their side of the experience of listening to the show, what was happening in their lives.
And is there a hierarchy on the death, sex, and money? Which of the three is easier? And does it, overlaying David's age question in a way, have you seen, you know, people can talk about death in their 30s and their 80s, but between it's too close? Or, you know, is there a ranking?
Yeah, I actually am starting to feel that with death, that it was like an interesting intellectual pursuit, and it's becoming less
knocking at the damn door,
less magnetic. I don't know, like, I think it sort of varies. I do feel the quality of not just death conversations, but talking about aging and diminishing capacity. Those are just sort of I feel it more when I'm doing those interviews than maybe I did 10 years ago. I feel like money is always hot and interesting to dig into. And you know, our show doesn't get into personal finance or that sort of thing, or prescriptive money conversations. But I find our sort of, you know, different emotions and identities in relation to class and money to be so rich and just so underexplored. And when I look out at what's happening in our country, I just see so much of our anxieties about money and status, like, animating so much of what's happening. So I just want more of those conversations, and also find it personally difficult myself to deal with money anxieties and identity. So I like exploring that a lot.
And are there two traits in the generation that's sort of in their, I guess, sort of under 30s that I think of right now that I find interesting around death or around sex and money? With money, the willingness for people to share what they make publicly, to talk about it, is really interesting. And on sex, the unwillingness to have it, like, that there are just so much less sex being had by young people. And
I
wonder,
I keep hearing about Tinder and things.
Tinder's for like people of our age, John.
The numbers are down.
That was
big.
I know. Sorry, that was gratuitous. Sorry, carry on.
But have you dug into either of those? Has that come across in any of your reporting?
Yeah, we just did this episode about inheritance, and I interviewed a young woman who has money that she inherited from her grandmother, and she's part of this group Resource Generation that talks about hoarding money. That's the language they use around family money. And she talked about the conversations she's had with her parents about why she's giving it away. She gave money to a friend who was an older lesbian to build a deck to enjoy in her older age. She's giving to causes. And it makes her mother uncomfortable because this is money that came from her grandmother with the intent on, you know, giving her something to have a stable nest egg. But I really liked that conversation because it sort of challenged maybe not the explicit values around money that I grew up around, but just the idea that, you know, money and family is about, like, leaving something for your kids is a form of love, and it's about providing for stability after you're gone. But it's also, you know, you could view it as hoarding and not sharing when you've got more and others have needs. Sharing publicly information about money, yes, I have noticed that. And I'm in this, like, I was born in 1980, so I feel like I can kind of tap into some of these younger people's sensibilities. And then there's other ways. I'm very, like, Gen X. And I would never tweet what I earn, but I will, like, go out with colleagues and tell them what I earn. But it's important to me to be able to have those conversations in context and to also understand how they're going to use that information. Like, I wouldn't want to have a conversation with someone and have them do a TikTok about my personal financial information.
One of your classic episodes, I think, is one you did with Senator Alan Simpson that was about your now husband, and it was about Simpson's intervention on behalf of Arthur when he
was... Amazing episode.
It's really an amazing episode, and you just revisited it recently. I confess I have not listened to the revisiting of it, but I just thought I'd love to hear about what it was like to go back to that story.
I mean, it's so wild because it's one of the most just... special things that's happened in my entire life. Like, it was a wild, kooky thing that Arthur decided to do when we were broken up, and he wrote this letter to Senator Alan Simpson. And then Alan Simpson and his wife Anne picked up the phone and called me to talk to me about my love life, which was
to
wild.
Give Arthur another chance, basically,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. And then the other thing that was so cool, you know, Arthur could have just that he... I, you know, could intuit that they are people who really, they talk to everybody about love and relationships and getting through hard times. Like, everybody in Cody, Wyoming has an experience of having Ann Simpson pull them aside and help them through something, or her try to fix them up. And we got to experience that. Like, they, and then I asked them if I could sit down in their kitchen and talk to them about their marriage, which included some, you know, difficult times, and sometimes when Anne was, like, embarrassed by Al, you know, she didn't like how he looked on television, the way he interrogated Anita Hill during the Clarence Thomas hearings, and they talked about that. But I guess revisiting it now, it sort of feels like this artifact of, I hear it as the beginning of what's become, like, a truly, like, precious relationship in our lives. You know, they are still really good friends of ours. I see them several times a year when we're in Wyoming. They came to visit me when I had my first baby in Cody. They were the first visitors after my parents. Like, so it feels, I don't know, like, it's moved out of the realm of, like, wild and weird and cool podcast episode to just this, like, incredible relationship that we get to have. They will have been married 70 years later this year, and they're both in their early 90s, and they're wonderful friends.
Alan Simpson, one of my favorite quotes was, in Washington, sometimes you're on the cover of Time No, 1 minute you're on the cover of Time, the next minute you're doing time. Anna, can I ask you, Anna, about your most recent episode about Patrick? Explain who Patrick is, and also your, as an interviewer, particularly on these subjects, and what listeners can already figure out from listening to you, is you have to be alive and empathetic and all of your open pores open to kind of take in information from the way the conversation's going. And did you find that different or odd, either emotionally or intellectually, when you're talking to somebody who has been diagnosed as a sociopath?
I did not know what it was going to be like to talk to Patrick. Patrick Gagné is a clinical psychologist, a PhD, and she's just released a memoir called Sociopath, about what it was like to come of age as a sociopath and to not have that language, and then to have that language to understand why she responded differently emotionally than people in her family and people around her. And she described it as having an emotional learning disability. And she also used the word neuroatypical to describe her experience. And so in going into it, I was, even just what it was going to be like to talk with her, I didn't know if her delivery was going to be sort of flat and detached and we would struggle to connect in the way that I'm used to in interviews where I'm digging into someone's life. But I, you know, you don't hear that at all. And I asked her about it and she's like, oh, well, you're also hearing like, this is, I have learned charm. I have learned how to fit in, basically. And it was interesting because on the one hand, to come of age as a woman, she's a little older than me, you know, in the 80s, without like shame registering in a deep way, I was like, what's that like? And that sounds fantastic and how liberating. That was really fun. And but also, you know, when you think about what you derive from secondary emotions, which are the emotions that you sort of develop that register in relationship, she doesn't have that. Like, if you can't register guilt and shame, you can be a real asshole and not care about it, not care about the harm that you do to other people. And so I asked her about, you know, the violent compulsion she's had, including stabbing a little girl when she was in elementary school with a pencil. And
that story is nuts.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And that, like, it didn't even, she described it as feeling for her like she was popping a balloon with a pencil when it was a child's head. So what did I think? I just found it really fascinating. And then I was interested where she like couldn't follow. Like, I asked her about anticipatory grief, if she experienced that. And she was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And it's like, oh, that's so interesting. Because that feels like such a, you know, full, it's just like, if you hear that and you felt it, you'd know it. And I had to describe, I was like, oh, how do I describe it? It's a mix of dread and love all together. So I don't know, I found it really interesting. So not difficult. And then of course, I've heard from listeners and from people in my life, like, do I have sociopathic tendencies? Yeah. Am I on the spectrum?
That 5% figure probably woke some people up. There's actually,
seriously,
Patrick Page, the Shakespearean actor, just did a show of all of Shakespeare's villains, or most of them, and talks about sociopathy in the context of Iago. So this was extraordinary to listen to after that, and the thinking through the various Shakespeare characters who those who have a conscience and those who don't, basically.
So oh, that's cool. That should be a DSM plus interview.
Yeah. There you go. Talk to him. He's amazing. Seriously, he's so good at this. And his voice, the greatest voice. That would be really, I'd love to hear you two talk.
Anna Sale is host, creator of Death, Sex, and Money, now available wherever you get your Slate podcast, wherever you get any podcast, but part of the Slate family. Anna, thanks for coming on Slate Plus.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for building podcasts at Slate for us to be able to join in on. I love what you all do and that you've been doing it together for so very long.
Thank you. Bye, Slate Plus.